We're really excited to kick this panel off today with two absolutely wonderful speakers. Sabrina Balgamwala is the director of the Asylum and Immigration Law Clinic at Wayne State Law School, and she used to be a professor here at the University of North Dakota School of Law, so we're particularly excited to have her back. And Monique St. Germain is general counsel for the Canadian Center for Child Protection, which is an entity that's focused on the protection of children from sexual exploitation and abuse. And I'd like to kick it off by asking each of you to talk about how your experience ties into the themes of this conference. So what is your experience with trafficking, and how did you come to this subject?
Thank you. First, I have to say how awesome it is to be back here. Thank you so much to Law Women's Caucus and to UND for having me. I used to direct the immigration section of our clinical program here. That's what I do now at Wayne State. I'm an immigration lawyer by training, and I came into being professor later. And that's how I approach the issue of trafficking. All of my clients are immigrants, and the ones I work with who've experienced trafficking are looking for assistance, particular remedies that are available to survivors of trafficking and also labor exploitation. This will be interesting, having me in the mix, I think, today, because I work with adults specifically and a mixture of men and women, and I have some interesting perspectives, I think, on gender and how that plays a role. So, I'm interested in being part of the discussion.
Hi. So I'm also very happy to be here, and I was very happy to be at the dinner last night and learn so much about Helen Hamilton, about whom this day is all about. I had never heard of her before, and now I'm very inspired. I want people to have a day after me. In terms of how I came to the issue of trafficking, I mean, really, the work of the Canadian Center for Child Protection is focused on sexual exploitation and abuse of children. So that obviously runs the gamut from being abused within a home setting to being abused on the streets. So it's part of the work that the agency does, and the agency touches upon a number of different areas, but all focused in that specific realm. So the way we come at, because of the work that the center does, the way we come at it is very much on the technology side of things, and I'll probably have an opportunity to explain a little bit more about the organization in a bit.
Start with some introduction into the law. So we understand that there are a lot of laws that are aimed at trying to combat trafficking, and I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about, and I'll start with you, Monique, about what the laws are like in Canada on the issue, and then maybe, Sabrina, you can talk about international law or federal U.S. law.
I'm not really going to be able to speak to human trafficking in general. That's not my area of expertise. Right. So there is in Canada, we're a federally based country. So our criminal law is the Canadian Criminal Code. So it's the same across the country. We have the offense of human trafficking, which covers all of the different aspects of human trafficking. The part that we intersect with, of course, is the part that pertains to children under the age of 18. What we see most often is in Canada, because the human trafficking provisions are relatively new, from a legal point of view, a lot of the times when prosecutors or police are charging, they don't use that offense as the charging offense. It's often a whole plethora of other offenses that everybody's a lot more comfortable with and understands. So I don't think that we've got in Canada a true picture of the human trafficking issue specifically, partially because of that, because we are using sort of the wrong offenses. That's not really right, because of course it fits, but it's not encapsulating that extra part of it, with which is the human trafficking part.
Belting out, yeah. So, I think that has been my experience as well, Monique. That actually U.S. trafficking law is relatively young. The Trafficking Victims Protection Act was only passed in 2000 as a part of the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. So that's where we see our trafficking law, which encompasses a couple of key themes. One is exploitation. So that that could be sex exploitation or it can be labor exploitation. And specifically exploitation or labor or sex work obtained through the use of force, fraud, or coercion. So that's what makes it exploitative. And for sex offenses involving children, right, you don't have to show force, fraud, or coercion because they're unable to consent. And so that becomes part of our trafficking law as well. And it's true that trafficking-ish offenses were prosecuted under different types of laws, right? A lot of that was brought under the same umbrella during the trafficking when the TVPA was passed. But there are some interesting sort of precedents in both in the United States and internationally. In the U.S., the Mann Act, which there are some offenses that are still prosecuted under the Mann Act. It was also known as the White Slave Traffic Act, which is kind of interesting because slavery was happening and it was not, prior to that. And this was something that was attended to address what was perceived as a completely different problem. I'm not sure that those problems are entirely different, but that was certainly the perception at the time. And internationally, there was, in 1904, there was an international agreement for the suppression of white traffic. So beginning in the early, late 1990s, actually specifically in the 1970s, because of the Convention for Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, trafficking sort of became perceived as a women's issue, and that's not entirely unrelated, right? It makes sense with the origins of the Mann Act and the White Slave Traffic Act that it was specifically focused on protecting women, and later women and male and female children, but not necessarily male adults. So it became kind of seen as a women's issue. And between CEDAW and then and which was followed up by the Beijing conference internationally talking about women's issues and the progress on the status of women. In the late 1990s and 2000 is when we see sort of the bringing sort of these various, revisiting these older forms of protection in trafficking cases and making them more inclusive. And so in 2000, that is when the International Trafficking Protocol was passed. It's interestingly a part of the UN Convention on Transnational Organized Crime, and I think it's interesting that it kind of came under this criminalization protection as opposed to a labor protection or a human rights type of protection, that it was really seen as a criminal law issue, that trafficking was something that we needed to use law enforcement specifically to address. But all of that happened around the same time. And again, the international definition is focused on these things. It's focused on coercion or coercive methods to take advantage of people who, I actually wrote this down because this is like one definition that I don't engage with a lot. But it's tended to talk about sexual exploitation or labor exploitation and taking advantage of people who are vulnerable. So you can see there's a huge overlap in the development between international and U.S. law, and I wouldn't be surprised if, Canadian law as well.
Monique, I'm going to demonstrate my utter ignorance of Canadian law with this question. I wish I knew more. So it sounded to me as if you said that it's the criminal code is largely, and I don't know if this word, but federal, that it's sort of applicable all over Canada. Is that correct? Are there any sort of provincial laws?
Yes, so, but not criminal ones. So the way that the criminal law works in Canada is that it is only the criminal code. And in fact, there's a bit of a history to that in that years ago, the UK, which of course we're largely based on UK law, they had been trying to codify their criminal law into one unified criminal code. They abandoned the idea, but we liked it, so that's why we have one. It's useful in the sense that you've got the same law. So whether you're looking at a case from the province of British Columbia or the province of Nova Scotia, theoretically, the interpretation and analysis should be the same. That's not really the way it plays out in practice all the time. time, but certainly you are starting from the same spot in terms of what the wording of the law is. But provincially in Canada, we do have some provinces that have passed provincial human trafficking pieces of legislation. So those pieces of legislation enable someone who's been trafficked to sue their trafficker. So there's a tort element. Of course, that's not going to be a remedy that's going to be accessible to everyone, but it is in some of those provincial pieces of legislation. The other thing that the provincial pieces of legislation do is enable protection orders and other things that can be availed. So, and then connected to that, some provinces have something called a Missing Persons Act, and that ties to this issue because a lot of times if somebody is being trafficked or is at risk of being trafficked, sometimes what's happening is that they're going missing for periods of time, or perhaps they are missing. And so the Missing Persons Act is a way to enable police to get access to various pieces of information to try to locate the person, as opposed to a criminal law thing, which is going to engage all sorts of charter protections, constitutional protections, that sort of thing.
Well, like, I've learned about Canadian law today. I'm so excited. I'm excited to hear more about that. So, Sabrina, you talked a bit about international law and federal law. Do we have states or localities that are trying to talk about trafficking as well?
So that's both on the both on the legislative side as well as the civil society side. So, and I think you're going to hear more about efforts specifically in North Dakota to address the issue of trafficking in persons. What has been interesting, I mostly know about state and local trafficking ordinances through sentence enhancements. So when things are often, if things are prosecuted, maybe as a sex exploitation case, the sentence can be enhanced if it's a trafficking offense. A lot of these are kind of related to efforts specifically to combat sexual exploitation and commercial sex work. Sometimes I think those converge in helpful ways. Sometimes I'm not sure that they converge in helpful ways. There are one interesting initiative that exists in New York City is actually human trafficking courts, which are intended to be diversionary. There are some mixed results from those courts, but the idea that maybe a trafficking offense is a way to bring someone into this court where they might be seen as a as a perpetrator, right? If they're a sex worker, then maybe they're facing prostitution charges. But this is a program that's intended, through the local system that's set up that allows people to come in and get a judge to look comprehensively at their case, including the role that played. So there's kind of some interesting things, but mostly on the intersection with the criminal justice system, I think. And that's where I think the civil society piece is really important, where you're bringing folks from, from law enforcement, but also people who work in the social services side and everything, because addressing trafficking comprehensively is really important. You're going to hear all about that later. I'm excited.
It's been great to give us a sense about what the law, the legal framework is, both the Canadian framework, the U.S. framework, the international framework, how states and provinces are getting involved. What I understood from your comments, too, is that there is a real breadth of conduct that falls within trafficking, and it sounds like your experiences really diverge. Monique, can you tell us a little bit about how, sort of factually, what is trafficking and the kinds of things that your organization sees and deals with?
Question. I need to provide a bit of context about what our organization is and what we do, because it's a little different from the panel you're going to hear from next, which is more sort of on the ground and direct. So, in terms of the work that we do, we're the main program that we operate is cybertip.ca, which is Canada's online reporting center for the sexual exploitation of children. So any sexual exploitation of children that has some sort of a technological or online component, the report can come into us, and what our agency does is make sure that that report and that information makes it to the law enforcement agency with jurisdiction. So back in 2002, when we were first piloted in the province of Manitoba with the support from the government of Manitoba as well as the federal government, it was largely to deal with the issue of child pornography on the internet. So that is an issue that is, of course, exploded in terms of what's online. And in terms of, it's a spectrum in terms of the way that we see it, in that a lot of the images that we're dealing with where somebody's going to take action or take it down or police are going to take action are the images that involve very young children. It's really obvious that they're a child. It's really obvious that there's a sexual abuse going on, etc. There's no issues of consent that you need to worry about because they're so young. When you're talking about teenagers, and these are the ones who are often sort of engaged in and what we're looking at when we're looking at sex trafficking victims, for example, it's not as simple always to tell that they are children. And so dealing with those types of images can be a bit more challenging. So in terms of our agency, we process the images and we figure out where they're hosted and we forward it to law enforcement agencies, which often are outside of Canada because a lot of this content isn't actually hosted inside Canada, but because of the internet, we're all connected, and it doesn't really matter where it's hosted. It more matters where the victim is. So then trying to figure out who that victim is a whole other story. Law enforcement's working on that, of course, and then there's international agencies that work on that as well. So the other piece that our agency intersects with is the advertising online for the sexual exploitation of children. So these are, the Craigslist ads, the Backpage ads, those sorts of things. So we'll get reports of those types of ads. And again, that's a forwarding off to law enforcement. So part of what we're trying to do is figure out, is the ad about a child or does it appear to be about a child? And then which law enforcement agency needs to know and how should we be pushing in terms of making sure that there's some action taken with respect to that.
A follow-up to make sure I understand that what you're largely then is saying is your agency is focused on trafficking in the context of children, and it's really sexual exploitation of children, and it sounds like sexual exploitation of children in a range of age, but I'm guessing all just under 18 being the definition of child.
Absolutely. And a lot of the stuff that we intersect with online is involving the very young children.
Sabrina, you know, you mentioned earlier about talking about trafficking in the context of sexual exploitation, but also the context of labor. What would labor trafficking look like?
Right, and I think that that question how I come to it is sort of a direct result of my orientation as an immigrant rights advocate. Right, I don't represent necessarily the public interest, or I do maybe one person at a time. I have individual clients with different situations, and it's my job to, you know, explain their options to them and advise them. And I think it's really hard for folks who are involved in labor trafficking situations. The immigration laws in the United States, well, I'd say in a lot of places, right, we're not unique in that respect, are very strict. And there are very limited ways for people to come to the U.S. And there are very intense both push and pull factors, right? The ability to support oneself or one's family through income earned in the United States is very intense. That's a lot of pressure that people deal with in very serious ways. And there's some very intense push factors, like a lot of my clients come from places that are not very safe places to live. They're not places where they want to raise their kids. There's some interesting stuff about women escaping traditional gender roles. And so when those push and pull factors are very intense, people will undertake pretty risky endeavors in order to get to the United States and have an opportunity. And so people will take opportunities sometimes maybe knowing that this opportunity isn't what it appears to be, that it's not as good as it sounds, but maybe are not aware of just how bad it is at the time when they sign up. So it's kind of this interesting thing, you know, this requirement of force, fraud, or coercion to show that there's trafficking. I think some folks are worried that they're not going to be totally seen as being on the right side of the law because they weren't, you know, there, maybe the coercion is really, it's not obvious. people find out about these opportunities oftentimes through people they know. So there's people in their community who will share these opportunities with them. Sometimes they are related to these people, or they're part of, they have deep kinship networks. It's not so common for people to fall in these situations based on people they know. And so that is where I really kind of see why I'm so serious about my role as someone's individual advocate, because when someone decides to reach out to law enforcement because of the experience that they are, you know, trying to decide whether to do that based on something they had at the job, they often had a lot of questions, you know, am I going to get in trouble because maybe I knew something that this opportunity was something different than what was advertised or what was said. Or maybe I moved from one employer to the other and I wasn't allowed to do that under the terms of my visa. I'm worried about getting, you know, my, you know, family member or friend in trouble. I'm worried about what's going to happen to my family at home if I say something, or even karmically, like this weird, like something bad is going to happen if I talk about this person. I mean, that's like the level of like, the things that people are dealing with, and it's not, I don't consider it my job to force people to choose one course or the other, but the situations also, these themes arise, but the situations are very different. So when I was in DC, actually when I was a clinic student in law school, I had clients who had actually been trafficked by diplomats who were here in the United States. And those diplomats could not be prosecuted because they had immunity. And so there was no room to go forward with law enforcement. And yet these people had so much at stake and had these terrible situations they were trying to escape. Their visa status, their family's ability to immigrate was all controlled by an embassy over which this diplomat had some control. It was like a truly horrifying situation. Diplomatic trafficking is like a whole separate thing, and yes, horrors unto itself, right? So, but then there's also other types of, you know, guest worker trafficking, which is really common, or guest worker exploitation, these programs that bring people to the U.S. to work for temporary periods of time. And those programs are not always great. People are not always treated well. Those employers have control over those individuals' housing and transportation, whether they eat every day, whether they see a doctor, whether they have any time off. And that's a lot of control for an employer to have. It kind of can lead to a bad situation. So it can be a range of things. But I appreciate the opportunity to kind of lift that up, because I think that stuff gets lost. And I think sometimes folks are so worried about suffering the consequences for how they immigrated that we don't necessarily hear their stories of the things that are happening to them.
Both of you mentioned a word that I think is really important to come back to, which is vulnerability. Monique, can you talk about the vulnerability of the individuals who, the victims of that you see through the online work?
It's interesting that you asked that, because as she was talking, I was thinking, wow, that sounds a lot like children, everything that she was saying. You know, you're under the control of parents, or you don't want to say anything because you don't want to ruin things in your world, or depending on what you've been made to do, you may feel complicit, you may feel like you're going to be charged with something, you might feel like you're going to get in trouble. And that's a really, really hard cycle to break out of. Very, very difficult. And certainly for the work that we've been doing with survivors of child sexual abuse material, legally known as child pornography, that's what they say, is that at the time they couldn't come forward and tell anybody, didn't feel comfortable with telling anybody because of those fears and all of the different ways in which this issue will intersect in their lives. So it's really similar, I think. I think the experiences actually would probably be quite similar in that respect, in terms of the emotions, in terms of the barriers to coming forward. The benefit, I guess, for children is that we're all sort of responsible for protecting children. And as adults, we're all responsible for, raising the alarm bells if something doesn't seem right. Some children, though, aren't in situations where there's people around them who are able to do that, or they're not being seen by sort of people in other places. So one example that I can think of that we seem to see coming up with increasing frequency in some of the situations that we're intersecting with is homeschooling. So if a child is homeschooled, there isn't anybody who's seeing that child on a regular basis and who's able to intervene, whereas at least if the child is going to school every day, there's a teacher, there's other people, there's other children in the school who can sort of notice if something is amiss. So that's a big deal. And I totally understand the reasons why people might want to homeschool in various situations. But at the same time, that really increases the vulnerability of children to all sorts of different horrors.
Sounds like there's age, there's control, and then the lack of other people intersecting with them in their lives that are all contributing to this vulnerable status.
Those are contributing factors. And there's a whole host of other factors that can arise as well, right? And I think it's very complicated because not all children are in the same place. So in terms of the imagery that we see online, which really is evidence of the fact that this is happening to children on a regular basis around the world, is that we see children from all ethnic diversity. So, you know, we that means that it's happening all over. So you can't say that it's necessarily all in concentrated in one area. That doesn't mean that it isn't happening more frequently in certain ethnicities than others. But at the same time, it is it's the status of childhood that's the vulnerable factor.
Interesting that you say that too, especially in light of what Sabrina, you said at the beginning about the Mann Act being the White Slave Traffic Act, right? That this isn't an issue of white slavery. This is an issue that is crossing all genders and races and ethnicities. Sabrina, could you talk about vulnerability? You've mentioned it before, but what makes immigrants vulnerable? I have a lot of thoughts on that. Well, what makes these folks vulnerable to trafficking?
Gonna pass the microphone right back to you. I think that the vulnerability around citizenship status really can't be discounted. I mean, there are so many different ways to be in the United States. Some people have no status at all. Some people are in violation of the status that they came in with. So that is a whole separate thing. They had something and now they don't. There are people who are here for a limited purpose to work for a particular employer. There are folks who are here to go to school and aren't supposed to be working. There are folks who have permanent residence and folks who have citizenship. And everyone is going to experience a different kind of vulnerability. And I could say that some on their face are more vulnerable than others, but the reality is that it's so specific and that people are vulnerable in different ways, right? And that's, we talk about gender as a point of vulnerability and age as a point of vulnerability, but citizenship status, language proficiency, amount of time that a person's been in the United States, the number of social connections they have, this problem of being in isolation, right? Exploitation happens in isolation. So the more connected people are to their communities, and the thing that actually has been so hard for me is having conversations with clients about cooperating with law enforcement and people feeling that they cannot, that they are vulnerable to law enforcement in a negative way, right? We think about this is the way that people are going to get protection that they need, but people are afraid of police for various reasons, and that's actually a common threat that employers will use, is say, I'm going to call Customs and Border Patrol, I'm going to call ICE, I'm going to call the police, and you're going to jail for working here or for being in violation of your status, and people know that those are consequences. So it's very hard to encourage people to cooperate when they feel vulnerable in the presence of folks who have these other responsibilities.
Add to that, that reminded me of something else too. So it's not in the child space, it's not going to be just police, but it's also going to be uncomfort or discomfort with involving child and family services, which is what it's called in our province, because it's generally the child then who's removed from the home if there's any sort of issue that's going on, and so it's the child who ends up bearing the brunt. And you know, sometimes it's better to be in a home where maybe everything's not perfect, but at least you have parents who love you and who will care for you. And the other thing in terms of the vulnerabilities, which I should have mentioned and totally forgot, was about the disability aspect. So children with disabilities, we know that they are sexually abused and exploited at a far greater rate than other children. So these disabilities can take a number of different forms, but these are the children that are open to be preyed upon, and it's much easier for somebody who has a deviant sexual interest in children to target those children with disabilities.
I did not know that, actually. That was really educational for me. I mean, once you say that, it becomes immediately apparent. And we actually locally have had a case in that get a lot of widespread attention here in North Dakota. But that is a really important thing. Another thing that you guys mentioned in addition to vulnerability, I think we should spend a moment on, is this idea of exploitation at the hands of people who know you. And so I'm wondering, Monique, you know, we imagine it's parents, but I imagine it's broader than parents, and sort of, you know, who has access to children.
So in terms of the info, I mean, you can look at a number of different sources. So there's statistics that will tell you about police-reported sexual offenses against children. That's only representing a sliver of the sexual offenses against children because there's a number of different things that have to happen before something goes to police. So first of all, the child has to say something or somebody needs to discover it. Then whoever the child tells or whoever discovers it has to actually take action to protect the child and then go to police, and then the police have to believe the child and then think that they have enough evidence to actually press charges. And then the Crown, which is the prosecutors, that's how prosecutors are referred to in our jurisdiction, the Crown has to believe that there's a reasonable prospect of conviction, and then it has to go to court, and the police have to have obeyed the charter, constitutional rights of the accused all the way through. The child has to oftentimes come and tell their story and be cross-examined and withstand that kind of scrutiny, etc. There's a number of different things that have to go through, especially if you're going all the way to sort of conviction. So, you know, the police report is only going to represent part of it. But at the same time, you know, so we know that there's a number of different or a number of children who aren't coming forward, who don't come forward until adulthood. There's a lot of research that supports that, that they finally feel comfortable talking maybe to a therapist when they're an adult. So what we're seeing, one of the things that our agency does is we monitor reported case law from across Canada, all on the sexual abuse and exploitation of children. So any case that involves, as long as it's criminal in nature and it involves sexual abuse and exploitation, we're looking at it. And that's helping us to understand a lot of different things that you can't get out of statistics. You really sort of can get more understanding of the techniques that the abusers are using, who the abusers are. Clearly, or what we're seeing in reported case law, just like you'll see in reports to police, it is overwhelmingly parents. They're definitely the majority, but it's not always the biological parent. So it could be the stepdad who comes in. Sometimes it's the mother who makes the child available to someone, not because she's sexually deviant, but as a way of keeping someone in their life and not really fully appreciating that the person is in their life because of their child and not because of them. So we'll see that. But then we also will see individuals who will give kids, particularly vulnerable kids, what they're missing from their lives. So love, attention, flattery, gifts, other things like that is one way of getting them to trust you, like you, and then feel like they're in a relationship with you, which then is the groundwork for being able to sexually exploit and abuse them. So there's a number of different things. The other thing that we've really noticed is that when it isn't a family member involved, so if it's somebody outside of the family, it's a teacher, it's a coach, or another sort of person in the neighborhood who lets the kids hang out at his place, is often men, alcohol and drugs. Huge factor in, you know, that breaking boundaries, allowing the child to come to their home and drink and providing that freedom and boundary breaking behavior that, you know, is the spice of adolescence. But at the same time, that reduces inhibitions and can again, lay the groundwork for abuse and exploitation.
As well, this idea of being exploitation coming at the hands of people you know. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, the auntie who comes and offers a great job as a cleaning maid, right? You know, how does the how does this work? You know, with adults, you're thinking they're adults. How could they be? We've talked about what makes them vulnerable, but how does this layer of someone you know come into play?
Right. I actually thought most recently about this very deeply because before, in addition to doing immigration work, I was specifically a domestic violence attorney for a few years, and something that was always uncomfortable but important for me to sit with is that people can be treated badly by people in their lives. They can be threatened. They can be, you know, people can be killed by people that they love and that they care about. And that you have to hold both of those things in the same space, which is sometimes very hard. You know, convincing people to, you know, it's one of those things, like being available if someone wants to leave a bad situation, but ultimately it's not my decision. And that is, that's hard, but I think it's really important because sometimes when you're asking someone to leave a situation, you are asking them to leave all of their social connections behind. And that's not, these are the people who they have spent time with, people for whom they care. And that's something that's sometimes fostered in these situations, right, as a way of like creating a second family or a loyalty with norms, and people feel like they belong to something like that. And that by ripping someone, like that's how it feels, like ripping someone away from this thing that has sustained them. I can't do that. That's kind of my client's decision to make. And so I sort of have approached it maybe in the same way. And there's been a lot of there's especially this idea of autonomy feminism that the best way that you can lead somebody to, you know, you don't lead someone, you don't make the decision for them. The best thing is to say that someone is going to make a decision based on what is most important and valuable to them in that moment. And sometimes those are the relationships, and it's tempting sometimes to pathologize that, saying you've been brainwashed, but then I'm like, but who am I to say? Like, really, this person is in an interconnected social network, and who am I to look at the situation and say, think that I know more about it, knowing nothing about them and not being in the position of leaving my family behind, leaving my friends behind, right? And so it's hard.
A question before I turn it over to the group and see if we have questions in the audience. But what do you think could be done better? Anything? Right? So, no, that's too big. That's too big. People have always, you know, as an immigration person, people come to me and say, what's your idea for comprehensive immigration reform? And I'm like, oh, sure, 2 weeks, let's sit down. But if you could pick one thing, if you could just pick one thing that could be done, either individually, the Crown, the government, law, not law, but if you think there's one thing that could be done, even a small thing, what would you pick?
Okay, that's a really, really hard one because I have a million ideas. But from everything, if I were to sort of distill everything that I've, over the last 8 years that I've been with the center, all the things that I've learned and all the things that I've seen, it's that we don't prioritize children enough. We really, really don't. When other interests are competing with the interests of children, we prioritize other interests, and we do it constantly and in almost every sector. And whether it's we're talking about government funding, whether we're talking about departments, everything else, I think that children have to be front and foremost of the considerations on all policy issues. How is this, whatever the policy is, how is this policy going to impact children? Might it, you know, hurt children in some way? And if so, how can we alleviate or mitigate against that, etc.? I would say considering children as part of the equation and not subsuming them under status of women issues, because while women and children issues are connected, certainly, there are two types of children. There are girls and there are boys, and they're not the same. They don't need the same things necessarily. And they have different considerations, and we also have a different obligation as a society towards children. Not that we don't have an obligation towards women, so I am one, totally on board with women, but what I mean is that we have different things that we can do with children. There's different tactics that we can take, there's different approaches that we can take because they're children. So I do think that if there was one thing, it would be that. It would be that children would be considered all the time and separately from everyone else.
I'm going to ask for two things. one is that I think, so right, Monique, what you said in terms of like some interests being above others, working on the labor exploitation and trafficking side, corporate interests are always more important than the people who work for those corporations. There are entire industries that thrive on worker exploitation. These are situations that are obvious. They're like so clear, and employers get let off with fines and people have their lives destroyed. Unfortunately, I think that that walks hand in hand with our immigration system and thinking about ways of making people enjoy the benefit of citizenship, not naturalized citizens, but feeling like they belong, feeling like they have roots, that they are not going to be targets of law enforcement for the wrong reason, and that it's okay for them to come forward and that they're going to be believed, and that, you know, providing them with the assistance they need to stand up to exploitation in their workplace when literally that person controls everything. And the other thing I would think about is removing conditions on access to services for victims, because of limited resources, there is a prioritization of providing services to people who are cooperating with law enforcement. And I think that's important, right? If someone's cooperating, you need to provide them the support they need to get through that process. But there are plenty of people who won't be able to do that if their situations aren't taken seriously. They won't be able to leave situations and then think about their next options. They won't be that, and people, you know, end up in these situations because of poverty and social isolation. And so removing some of those conditions, you know, really thinking about serving a broader range of people, like, you know, there's a lot of, you know, there may be more programs for women than for children. There may be more programs for women than for men. There may be more programs for citizens than non-citizens. And there may be more programs for people who've experienced sex trafficking than people who've experienced labor trafficking, and sort of thinking about those restrictions, and are we and LGBT people, I mean trans sex workers, like there are all kinds of vulnerable populations who are not getting served and they're being exploited because they're vulnerable. So if we could remove some of those restrictions and focus on the diverse needs among trafficking survivors, maybe more people would be able to come forward and tell their story.
All time, in case anyone in the audience has questions that they would like to pose to our panelists here.
To images, it doesn't matter, because the definition of child pornography is an image of a child under the age of 18. I might not have been totally clear when I was explaining it because I was trying to wrap something else in at the same time. So I'll go back and do a redo. What I was saying is that when you're looking at images of child pornography, there's the very obvious you're certain that it's child pornography because it's a child under the age of 12 who hasn't developed secondary sex characteristics. So you absolutely, it's a child. But once you start getting into teenagers, a 14-year-old can look like an 18-year-old. And it becomes much harder than if you're dealing with, let's say, a provider. If you don't know who that child is, and most of the time you don't, the provider can say, well, how do you know that this person's 14? Well, we don't, because we don't know who she is, right? We think she's young, but we don't know that for certain. So that's what I meant when I said it becomes more challenging. In Canada, the age of consent is talking about sort of in-person sexual activity, and that's what it's covering. When it comes to child pornography, Canada has criminalized everything and all images under the age of 18. So...
The two that immediately come to mind are food processing and agriculture work. I think those are
unfortunately, hugely underpaid jobs and sometimes not very regulated. There is a huge demand for labor in those sectors. Agricultural workers face a whole different set of problems because there are these weird exceptions carved out in worker protection laws that don't, so they just don't apply to people who work in these different sectors. And that's a, right, that's some legislative sausage making right there. There's some deals that were cut. I do not know that our food industry would thrive without exploitation of people. I mean, I think food politics are actually very tied up in this. So it makes it very hard for people to bring complaints against their employers and these are the industries, right, in which I mentioned that people are their every movement is controlled by their employers. The guest worker program in general has been something that's talked about as really something that needs reform because there's been so many issues. There was this, I told the story once before, but like it just chills my blood, so I'm going to share it with all of you. The workers who came in from South Asia, specifically from India and Nepal, to assist with the cleanup after Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. That program was famously exploitative, and a huge group of workers, terrified for their lives, ran away. The conditions were absolutely awful. They were working incredibly long days. They weren't being fed. The conditions were absolutely awful. They ran away, and the sheriff found them. This is the Deep South, right? And the sheriff found them and said, "I have to take you back because you belong to your employer." A place with a history of slavery, right? So, there are entire industries that have been called out time and time again, but there are not the legislative protections that apply to those programs that apply to other workers.
What we do when we work with survivors of sexual abuse and exploitation, it doesn't really matter sort of what their age is. It only matters sort of what happened to them. So we've certainly worked with young adults, and in particular, and it's a little bit off topic in terms of what this topic is, but we work with a lot of people under the age of 25 on the issue of non-consensual distribution of intimate images. So there's a lot of work that we do in that space with young adults. But no, it doesn't really matter. And in fact, one of the things that we did last year, well, actually it was going on for a couple of years, is we did an online survey of survivors of child sexual abuse material. So they'd been abused and their abuse was recorded. And we had them come in. The survey was translated into four different languages. And it was we had respondents from different parts of the world. And one of the things that we were really shocked to see, which actually is relevant in this context, was some of the survivors reporting experiences where they were abused sort of from the time they were babies until they were adults. So we would have one of the questions that we would ask is, at what age did your sexual abuse stop? And some of them said ongoing, like at the time when they're filling out the survey, and only adults were filling out the survey. And some of them would say, you know, 25, 30, et cetera. So I think that it would be a mistake to think that all sexual abuse of children stops when they turn 18 and then they're not being abused anymore or exploited. I think a lot of it continues on into adulthood, depending on the life circumstances of the individual and depending on what happened with them.
With that, I think I'm going to draw our first panel to a close. Thank you so much to our panelists. We have a short break. You guys can go back and have some more coffee and wonderful treats, and we'll regroup here at the top of the hour at 11 o'clock.